It's music of Mozart from The Marriage of Figaro, and reporter Carrie Seidman of the Herald Tribune asks the question, when it comes to opera, what makes Mozart Mozart? What is it that reveals his distinctive voice? Stage director Alison Grant replies, Mozartian is a vast term because it describes a vast talent. In three words, it means to me balance, beauty, and truth. Grant continues, in a seemingly simple duet between Susanna and the Countess in The Marriage of Figaro, commonly known as the letter duet, Mozart weaves the two voices in a single melody, one character completing the other's thought. He infuses the poetry with a longing that raises the somewhat prosaic plot of the moment into something sublime, a perfectly balanced, human, and beautiful moment. Let's hold on to Mozart and his weaving of two voices into one whole, which is really larger than the sum of the two voices, and move on to the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who asks as well about two becoming one. We're hearing a setting of an early Rilke poem titled The Song That Has Been Freely Translated by poet Dana Gioia. Gioia points to the musical comparison in the poem, the idea of love uniting two people like a bow that from two strings could draw one voice, like a bow that from two strings could draw one voice. Like a bow that from two strings could draw one voice. And we so often hear the wisdom expressed in the poetic tradition that in love you discover your true self revealed to you, reflected to you by the one you love. And Dana Gioia gives us a key insight here. He says Paul Salerni composed this song as a tribute to his teacher Earl Kim, on the occasion of his 75th birthday. Salerni has stated that he sat down to write it the way Kim would write it, though the listener never loses the sense of Salerni's individual voice. And so we have a wonderful web of interrelations. Composer Earl Kim loves Mozart. Earl Kim is Paul Salerni's mentor and becomes a much-loved and respected friend. Earl Kim is drawn to Rilke and begins to set his words. Dana Gioia, as a poet, freely translates Rilke. Opera director Laura Johnson loves Paul Salerni, her husband, and links him to Dana Gioia. And in one way or another, all these twos becoming larger than the sum of the parts, this coming together is reflected in this art song we just heard, titled simply, The Song. And all that ever touched us, you and me, touched us together like a bow that from two strings could draw One Voice. The song is the third of three in a cycle titled Speaking of Love, Poems of Dana Gioia, including the Rilke translation, set by Paul Salerni, one of many collaborations between the two colleagues become friends, Dana Gioia and Paul Salerni. Paul Salerni is an award-winning composer and National Endowment for the Humanities Distinguished Chair and Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem. Dana Gioia is an award-winning poet who served as chair of the National Endowment for the Arts and is Poet Laureate of California and Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture at the University of Southern California. There is yet another thread in all this wondrous weaving, as we remember the poet Rilke's attraction to the visual arts, especially to the French painter Paul Cézanne, and the impact interacting with Cézanne's work had on Rilke's discovering more deeply his own poetic voice. Composer Paul Salerni has launched a web-based project in which he brings his art songs and the visual arts together, posting one song a week with a painting, hoping to draw us into the conversation between and among music, words, and visual images. Dr. Salerni paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the project and the whole notion of finding one's voice as a creative artist. Interestingly, this highly respected composer of art songs had some trouble with his own singing voice.
This is the real irony of the story, because singing was, I was in the church choir for a very short amount of time, even though I was already musical because I was playing the accordion, but I preferred being an altar boy, so I stopped that. But I loved when I had to serve mass in the morning to hear the organist. We had a very good organist. I never sang in the choirs in high school. I joined the Amherst Glee Club, and I was kicked out in my junior year because I was so terrible.
You were terrible.
I was terrible. And I didn't like the choir director very much. And so choirs were never things I was comfortable with. And I didn't like song literature for as long as I can remember. And I didn't like the opera until I went to graduate school. And my beloved mentor, Earl Kim, said, you have to learn the entirety of the Marriage of Figaro. And that's when all of a sudden singing became wonderful to me.
And your life was transformed by that experience.
Absolutely transformed. Absolutely. I always loved Mozart, but I didn't know how much I loved Mozart and, you know, and the beauties of what one could do with the voice and one could express. And then, of course, I met my wife, who loved Italian opera and art song, and then spending time with Earl. So in the time I spent with Earl, often after dinner, we would go play forehand music, but we'd also read through Schubert and Schumann art songs. So that's where I acquired this love.
For people who may not be familiar with Earl Kim, just remind our listeners or tell our listeners about this special figure in your life.
So Earl was my professor at Harvard. I didn't think much of him until the third or fourth year when he actually came to see this opera production that I had conducted. And then I realized that he needed someone to help him with a production of his, an evening-long series of pieces on texts by Samuel Beckett. And I became his assistant for that and got to know him and his music very well. And that kind of transformed my life. And since then, I've been the champion of his music. And I think my aesthetic, what you hear from the music we're going to talk about, comes from this idea of doing things as directly and as economically as possible.
You stayed in touch with him then until he died?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the 2 days after he died, we were giving a concert of just his music, not a memorial concert. We eventually gave a memorial concert. Yeah, my wife and I lived with him for a summer because we were co-teaching a chorus during Harvard Summer School. We visited him at least 4 times a year, often during the holidays.
And where did he grow up?
Earl grew up in Los Angeles. So his family was one of the first families to emigrate from Korea. There's a book about the first 100 Korean families in Los Angeles, and the Kims are mentioned there. So he grew up there. He grew up poor. His parents eventually became grocers. He didn't learn anything about music until he went to the Hollywood Bowl and heard Puccini's Un Bel Dì, and he fell in love. And then he eventually went to the Los Angeles Community College. That's where he started his training. Ended up in the Army during the war. Flew over Nagasaki the day after it was bombed because he was an Army intelligence officer. When he came back from the war, or maybe it was before he went to the war, he studied at UCLA with Schoenberg. And then he went up to Berkeley and studied with Roger Sessions. And then he taught at Princeton and then taught at Harvard. And he's very little known, considering what a wonderful composer he was, but there were certain champions of his music that everybody will recognize, including Don Upshaw, great soprano, and Itzhak Perlman, for whom he wrote caprices and a solo concerto, a violin concerto.
It's so unusual to have someone whom you respect and love and who helps you grow and inspires you, and it must have been mutual because he must have seen and heard things in you.
He was a man of few words, and so it was always a deflected way of teaching, but it was always pointed. I remember the first piece I brought to him, first of all, he said, good. And then when I went out the door, the rest of my colleagues all gathered around and started like cheering me and saying, Earl said, good. Because he just never said that. And then I remember him pointing to one note in this piece, 5-minute-long piece. He said, that note's inactive. And I thought about it for 2 months, and I decided he was right, changed the note, and it was fine. It's that kind of, you know, perception.
What about the love of words? Because you have that as well, and you have a long-standing friendship with a remarkable poet.
Yeah, and I think, again, that's Earl's inspiration, because Earl was quite an unproductive, at least superficially unproductive composer until he discovered the words of Samuel Beckett. And in discovering the words of Samuel Beckett, he found an economy of means, an aesthetic, an architecture that he could emulate. And by, in some ways, translating those words into music, he found his voice. And I feel somewhat similarly about Dana Gioia. When I found Dana, then I took the stance that I was translating his words into music. I think I found my voice.
And a beautiful friend.
A beautiful friendship and a very productive one.
And tell us Laura's part in it.
Laura's part is that I wasn't a great reader. I loved poetry, but I wasn't a great reader. And one day I was in my composition studio. I know it was 1987. It was my first sabbatical. And she threw a New Yorker magazine on the desk and she pointed to a poem. She said, set this poem. And being the obedient husband that I am, I did. And it was a poem of Dana's. So she had a hand in it. She's had a hand in everything. She, for instance, chose the Dick Van Dyke TV show episode that I eventually made into an opera. So she's there.
What she does in her own creative life,
right,
is...
She's a theater and opera director, and so when my operas are staged, she does them. And so we've been a team for a long time doing that.
You set this poem. Why did she think it was something that you should set?
Number one, it was a good poem. The poem is called Garden on the Campagna. And it's a poem about a villa that's in disarray in Italy. And, you know, it's a very evocative poem about insects and things that are deteriorating. And the punchline is that there's an old man there and you can't tell whether he was the servant or the sire. So there's this wonderful ambiguity about it, but it's also setting a landscape that I love and I know.
So you had to approach Dana Gioia and ask for permission.
One always does with living poets. And yeah, so... Actually, I jumped the gun a little bit and did a kind of preliminary performance of what I'd written and sent it to him. And he said, oh, you know, you've totally screwed up my rhythms and everything, but I like what you write. So go ahead, have permission and take any poems of mine that you want and set them. And since then, I've said, you know, I can't count the number of poems I've set, but also written an opera with him and a number of Italian fables. And we're working on a new opera.
So you'll be in this seat again soon, I hope.
If all goes well, sometime before March 2nd, 2019, I hope you'll have me back.
We'll reserve the seat for you. And so in the course of your composing life, because you've been a remarkably respected composer and a teacher, and Earl was a teacher, as you've told us.
Yes.
And those things have brought you to Lehigh. Mm-hmm. And that's where you've been for how many years then?
This is my 39th year.
Cheers and congratulations on that. So you've been able to continue to do your own work, mm-hmm, and inspire, yep, your students and work with them and try to do for them what Earl gave to you, right?
And one of the lessons I learned is that, and I'm sorry I came to it so late, is that actually assigning young composers the idea of setting poems to music, setting text to music, actually helps them, because one of the difficulties for young composers is to find architecture in the music, whereas poems give you an automatic architecture. And so that's one less element you have to deal with. And sometimes people find their voices. I have one wonderful student. Her name is Heather Gilligan. She teaches at Keene State in New Hampshire, who just put out a beautiful CD of art songs on Albany. It's just remarkably beautiful. So I'm proud of that.
So you have that first song. Then that was the first of occasional songs? Did you wait to be commissioned for song settings? Did you get excited and say, oh, I want to set more?
All of the above.
Yeah.
That song actually set me in the process of looking through the New Yorker for poems. And so then I said three more, and that became actually my first song cycle, which is really the oldest one on the new project. And then some commissions. So for instance, Two Part Invention, the lovely group duo in the Lehigh Valley, commissioned pieces for guitar, alto flute, and baritone. So that was a commission. Yeah, some commissions. Some when I see poetry I love, I just want to set it. And anytime Dana produces a new book of poems, I immediately find the ones I want to set and I do it.
And you asked him, you invited him to write about these particular choices that you've made on this Speaking of Love CD.
Yeah, so the Speaking of Love is really a CD that, even though it has a large quartet at the end, is really about the songs that I've set of Dana's. They don't have all of them, but most of them.
He seems to get what you're doing with his work. He's very articulate about music. Is he a musician?
Oh, he started life. He was an undergraduate at Stanford. His desired major was to be a composer. He decided didn't have it. So the next thing he could do, and he was obviously very verbal and literate, was to do the musical equivalent in the literature world, which is poetry. The rhythm is beautiful. The sound is beautiful. It's always beautiful. I don't want to diminish my own activity, but I always feel like I'm translating it.
But he clearly respects what you're doing.
I think he values them. When you go to his writing studio in his house in California, there's a whole archive of Salerni and Gioia, which is very sweet.
Yes. You have such a lovely gift. It's that beautiful spareness. You don't overdo it.
Thank you, Pete. I mean, and that's what I think Earl, in his totally deflected way, said, you know, this is right.
And the Rilke setting that you did in honor Earl, I listened to it without reading the notes first. I listened to the CD without reading the notes.
Oh, you're brave.
And then I went back and read the notes. I mean, I love each one, but there was something about that cut number eight, the Rilke setting that you did in honor of Earl, that just went, ooh. And I thought, this is really very important to Paul.
And yeah, and in some ways, I think that's that's very astute, because Garden on the Campagna is not as much a translation as this one is. So that's called the song. And it's interesting because when I sat down to set it, the poem of Dane is after Rilke. And so Earl was actually in the midst of setting Rilke at that point. He had just switched from Beckett. And so I said, okay, I'm going to write as if after Kim. And then taking the stance of Earl Kim, I still didn't give up my voice. But what I think I got was the approach of economy, directness, all that stuff. So you put your finger on it. In some ways, that was where Dana's voice helped me find my voice through Earl.
So you wrote it in honor of his...
In fact, the whole cycle was for a gift for his 75th birthday. And well, what the topper was, but that for his 75th birthday, we gave him the second festival in his honor at Lehigh. We had done it in 1990 on his 70th, and so this was the 75th. And so it was actually premiered for that.
You must hear in the course of your musical life so many singers. There's just something in the quality of the voice that you say, oh, if she would only do this, or if he would only do this. That's right. Just that you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's certainly a voice type that would fit this stuff, and certain voice types don't work. And, you know, I've been lucky to have a number of sopranos sing those pieces, all of them quite well. And I certainly love the voice that's there, Sophia Burgos, who is absolutely tearing up Europe right now as a new music singer. She's tremendous.
And what about these wonderful influences that you use? Because if people think, well, it's a cabaret song. No, what did I hear there? That's jazzy, but wait a minute. You really have this sense of being able, not pastiche, it's not pastiche. It's really this sense of understanding the language of these various genres and being able to marshal them.
Well, oh, God, thank you. Because that's, you know, it's something I'm conflicted about all the time and have come to have peace about, which is that I think my approach, and I think if you read Dana's poems, you'll see that he'll use whatever structure, whatever language, whatever meter it is that is best to express what he wants to express. So I think when I set a poem, I try to find a language that is the language that's going to best express it, even if it's not one that I think of as my personal language. So I will use whatever jazzy stuff I have. I will use whatever Italian stuff I'll have. I'll use things that are Irish. There's a whole set of Seamus Heaney poems that come at the end of the project where I will channel Irish music. And in some ways, one of the biggest moments of conflict that I had with Dana was when we were writing an opera together, and the libretto absolutely demanded that I speak in various voices, that I speak in a 1950s or 1940s Andrew Sisters voice, that I speak in a big band voice, that I speak like Verdi, that I speak like Puccini, that I speak like myself, and it all had to go into an opera. And so somehow, the idea that in order to make these characters real, to put in their mouths what they would sing, you have to do it this way. So you just do it because you want to express what you want to express.
You know that ultimately for us as people who are getting to know these characters and their hearts and to be moved by them,
in a certain sense, we need to hear their voices.
Right. I don't think you as the listener care that I just switch styles in the middle. You just care that you're getting an emotional charge out of it. And it was something that my reading and aesthetics, I had to just get over and say, okay, just do it. And also Dana was very good because they always provided me a transitional point, a spot where I could intersect verbally with what was going on.
Okay, so now we've got the background about you and song and voice and music and Earl and Dana. What about this project that you're unveiling?
So you'll have to be patient because there are so many threads that came together. First thing was that we did a song cycle of Dana's called For Love or Money. And I've been very concerned that classical music doesn't get enough play, that doesn't have enough attention, even though we have wonderful, wonderful places like WVIA. That's an oasis of great stuff that happens every day. Thank you very much. You're a gift to our area. I realized we were losing young people. And so I wanted to make sure that my music was in a place where young people could get it, and that's YouTube. And so I got a grant from the university to do some videos of the actual recording session of For Love or Money. That was one thing. Sometime later, I started writing for this wonderful duo of Jessica Bowers and Oren Fader. She's a mezzo, he's a guitarist. And one day I was reading an alumni magazine. I started reading about a poet named David Ferry, who was an Amherst grad and a Harvard grad. And I looked up his poems and I just started writing his poems. It turns out that the poems that I chose were all descriptions of paintings. There's a fancy word for that called ekphrastic. So I said, I'm going to set those. I set those. The Bowers Faders did it. It was wonderful. That summer, I was at my sister-in-law's organic farm in upstate New York. On the farm table was a book of photographs and poems called Something Permanent, photographs by Walker Evans, poems reacting to the photographs by Cynthia Rylant. I looked at those. Oh, I got to set those. I set those for them. So when I took ekphrastic songs and Something Permanent together, there were all these poems and songs about images. So I said, okay, I will follow up with the videos from For Love or Money to make videos of these that actually walk through the paintings. So all those things came together. Final lynch, I think, was, at the end of the summer, Christy Royson, librarian at Lehigh, called me up and says, you know, we want an archive of your music. Can you just gather all your music on PDF and we'll archive it so that it's all there. And as I was doing it, I started counting the number of art songs I'd written. It came to 52. And I said, why don't I just put one out a week for a year? And since I had all these YouTube videos now, I would make YouTube videos of everything else and do it for 52 weeks. That's how it came out. So the first 7 episodes were the 7 songs in Something Permanent. And so everything comes in a little different package. So that's a package where you actually see the Walker Evans photograph. And my colleague from Lehigh, Linda Gannis, has actually designed a kind of journey so that you go in and out of the details as the poem and the song talk about it. So it's a kind of journey through it. Whereas the second part, where we're on the second song of For Love or Money, is actually a video of people in the recording session.
In any case, it's that image, music.
Right, everything together. And some of them will be static, where you'll have a simple image. So when we do the piece we talked about, the song we talked about earlier, Garden on the Campagna, it will just be the words of the poem and a picture of the villa.
And we haven't yet touched on Touched, so talk to us about Touched.
Touched is the CD that came out 2 years ago on Albany Records, and it is mostly pieces for flute, guitar, and string quartet. But there are some songs on here, like probably my most popular set of songs is called Bad Pets, because everybody likes pets. So there's a song about a dog, a song about a cow, and a song about a cat. And then also another actually quite popular series of songs of mine called Regiment Sanitati Salerni, which are Italian songs that recommend the use of food to cure all your ills. So that's on there too. And then finally, another, they're all on this, is Generations. Generations is an interesting story. When I wrote The Life and Love of Joe Coogan, I happened to be invited to actually visit Carl Reiner at his house, which was one of the most wonderful days of my life. And again, my wife, Laura, is always there as my catalyst. She saw a poem on the wall by Carl's daughter, Annie, and she actually wrote it down. And I said it, and I loved it. It's called To Minnie LeBost. Minnie LeBost was Carl Reiner's mother-in-law. And a lovely poem I set for string quartet and mezzo. And then I asked Andy to send me the rest of her poems. She did. I found one more called Recipe for Life. And then I said, you know, I need a third. I can't find a right one. So she wrote me another one. And so that's how this ended up on the Touched CD.
And so we'll get to encounter those two as the year goes on.
Absolutely. Every art song I've ever written. And maybe some more if I write some between now and the end of the year.
And what do you think about in terms of this experience of now using the internet in this way? Is it going to affect the way you think about things in the future?
It may. I mean, I think that it is the vehicle. Almost, I now actually teach my courses at Lehigh from YouTube because everything is available. There's some downsides to that. What I hope it doesn't do is deter people from going to live concerts, because as much as I love the accessibility of all this, there's nothing like being in the concert hall. It's just, there's just a different experience. And I think that my young students who are not musicians, they get it. So I bring them to concerts. That's so different. So I want this to be an inspiration for people to come to concerts. In the pop music world, I think that the availability of all this stuff, the actual economic model is that people love these pieces and then they spend a lot of money to go see a live concert. I hope that's going to happen for us.
We know that in this online world, there are ways for people to not lift a finger practically and get access. How do we find these? We just type in Paul Salerni?
I think if you typed in Paul Salerni YouTube, you'd find it all. What I actually prefer, because I like to communicate with people, is, and there was a nice article in the Morning Call where they actually published my email address. If you send me an email, I'll put you on the list and you'll automatically get it. Every Monday morning at 7 a.m., you get the new link. And what's nice about that is I actually spend a sentence or two explaining what this piece is. So please write me at paul.salerni@gmail.com. It's the easiest thing in the world. If you miss the dot, I think it still gets to me.
It's lovely to have some sense that we are not just buying a CD of your work and hearing it in the comfort of our own home or in the car or wherever we choose to listen to it, but that when we're on this email loop with you, somehow we're
personally connected.
We're personally connected.
I think it's important. I think we need... This is something that also Dana is very concerned about when he was the chairman of the National Endowment, and he's the poet laureate of California right now, but he's concerned about making sure that as artists, we are public and that we are with the public and that we're not simply speaking to other artists. We're speaking to everybody who is interested in art at all, interested to take the time to do it. And so we want to have a very personal conversation. It's what my music wants to do with you, too. It wants to have a personal conversation with you. And so either way, through the music or directly, I'm happy. I'm an Italian. I love people. And so I just hope that your audience will get in contact with me and I'll put them on the list. We'd love to get feedback about any or all of the pieces.
How shall I lift it over you to other things?
Dr. Paul Salerni, an award-winning composer and National Endowment for the Humanities, Distinguished Chair in Humanities, and Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, speaking with us about his life in music, his works, and a web-based project in which he brings his art songs and the visual arts together, posting one song a week with a painting mostly, hoping to draw us into the conversation between and among music, words, and visual images. And as we heard, he'd love it if you sent him an email and he'll put you on his mailing list, paul.salerni@gmail.com. And Salerni is spelled S-A-L-E-R-N-I. Each week, Mondays, he'll send you a new link and you'll get a new art song and a new image combined, and then you'll wait for the next week. paul.salerni@gmail.com. And of course, he welcomes your comments.